We'll come to order. Good morning, everyone. We have a long schedule today, and we will do our best to get through it as quickly as we can, give everybody a chance to speak. We have Senator Beyer with us this morning, and so we're going to go first to Senate Bill 341. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 341, and we'll have Ross Day and Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator from District 9. Before you, Senate Bill 341, which is a bill that I sponsored to solve a problem that came up during the last interim where employment listing services or unemployment listing services was forced to stop operation in the state because our laws did not allow them to work. This is a company, and I'll let Mr. Day give you the specifics of it, but this is a company that helps get people back to work, something which is sorely needed in this state of ours. Hopefully, I don't know if you have it yet, but we've been handed out a letter from Commissioner Gardner, the Labor Commissioner. I wanted to make sure you had that to realize that we worked with the Labor Commissioner. He's in agreement with this bill and thinks it will help our employment situation in the state of Oregon. So I urge you to send this bill to the floor and get it moving so we can get people to Oregon and work in Oregon to work. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would have to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. We desperately need that, and so we appreciate you bringing this bill. Questions for Senator Beyer? Okay, Ross.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for your record, Ross Day. I'm not here in my usual capacity with Oregonians in Action. I'm here as a private citizen of hopefully fulfilling a promise I made to a former client of mine when I was in private practice. The client's name was Permanent Employment. What Permanent Employment does is, as Senator Beyer alluded to, they have an employment listing service. And what an employment listing service does, and they operate in 14 other states, what they do is they sell a subscription, basically help wanted ads, if you will, to people who are looking for work and for a fee. And with Permanent Employment's particular business model, they have access, subscribers have access to the service for a year. What happened in the litigation with the Bureau of Labor and Industries was that under the current employment agency statutes, you're not allowed to charge a fee prior to obtaining employment unless you're getting the fee from the prospective employer. That doesn't allow Permanent Employment and other employment listing services to operate their business model. So that certainly is a problem. We've worked with the commissioner's office on this issue. They recognize what the problem is, and you can see that from Commissioner Gardner's letter. What this bill specifically does is it exempts employment listing services from the definition of employment agency and then requires or allows the commissioner to adopt regulations to ensure that the consumer protections that are currently in the employment agency statutes are also afforded subscribers of employment listing services. I don't get into any more than any gritty details other than to say our concern here with the amendments that were adopted were to ensure the consumer protection standards that are currently in the employment agency statutes while still allowing employment listing services to operate. We don't want situations that occur like in Florida where folks say, for $50, we'll tell you how to get a job, a cushy job with the government, and somebody pays them $50, and they say, okay, how do we get a cushy job? And they say, go enlist in the Army. So so the amendments, I think, will address that. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions. One other thing, too, I got to make sure I put this on the record. I alluded to litigation between Permanent Employment and the Bureau of Labor and Industries. This bill is prospective. It's not retroactive. It is not intended in any way to relieve Permanent Employment of any of its legal obligations in the litigation. This is purely prospective. And I promised the bully that I would put that on the record.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll call bully Annette Talbot. Should we post that?
Morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Annette Talbot, Deputy Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor. You have quite a full agenda this morning, Madam Chair, so unless there's any questions, I don't have any prepared testimony other than what we put on the record as written testimony. But we were grateful to work with Senator Beyer and Mr. Day, and I think we've come up with a good public policy to recognize today's employment listing practices.
Thanks. Well, thank you for your sending the letters to help us understand this better. Any questions?
Okay.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 341A. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 341A. Representative Gallegos.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 341 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It perhaps been on the consent calendar.
Okay.
I don't know what the proper motion is to do that.
Well, Representative Gallegos moves Senate Bill 341A to the floor with a due pass recommendation on the consent calendar. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative
Berkley?
Aye.
Representative
Coughlin?
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum? Is excused. Chair
closed.
Votes aye. Motion carries, and we will have... It's all the consent, so we don't need a carrier. Thank you very much, and we're closing the work session on Senate Bill 341. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2172 and have the staff bring us up to date on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We reported this bill out of committee on the 8th of April, and it deals with PEBS being able to provide self-insurance programs. We rescinded the referral to Ways and Means. The Speaker's office rejected our motion to rescind the referral to Ways and Means and asked us to bring it back to committee so that we could refer it to Ways and Means.
Okay, Representative Vegas.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2172.
Representative Gallegos moves that the rules be suspended for the purposes of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2172. Are there objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Gallegos.
And Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2172 be referred to Ways and Means.
We have to reconsider the vote.
Oh, so then I move House Bill 2172. Right?
That we reconsider the vote.
We suspended the rules, now we have to.
Oh, okay. Here, I got it. I just have to read. Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2172 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the referral to the Committee on Ways and Means was rescinded.
Okay, Representative Gallegos moves that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2172 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the referral to the Committee on Ways and Means was rescinded. Are there any objections? So ordered.
Now, Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2172 be moved to the Committee Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Gallegos moves House Bill 2172 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Motion carries, and House Bill 2172 goes to Ways and Means. Close the work session. Commissioner Gardner in the room. Okay, House Bill 2341, it has a little bit more extensive work we need to do on it, so we're going to go to a work session on House Bill 3069. Open the work session. And we'll call John Van Landenham. Long name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Van Landenham. I'm a legal services lawyer in Lane County. I'm here to testify on behalf of a coalition of landlord and tenant advocates and groups supporting HB 3069. A week ago, you passed HB 2765, which is an omnibus residential landlord tenant bill for apartment tenants. This bill has to do solely with manufactured housing tenants, those tenants who own their manufactured home and rent the space in a manufactured home facility known as a park. There are quite a few members of that coalition here today. They include the Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon, Oregon State Tenants Association, Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, Oregon Rental Housing Association, and Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. The bill is intimidating. The amendments, the dash two amendments, are intimidating because they're 59 pages long and 14 sections. However, there are really only five issues in this bill. It's that long because two of the statutes that we amend are very long and complicated statutes, but the amendments are not that complicated. So what I want to do is very briefly run through what those five issues are and then answer questions. The main issue addressed by the bill has to do with sales of a home by a tenant. Again, the tenant owns the home. The tenant wants to be able to sell the home in the park. If the tenant can't sell the home in the park, it costs a bunch of money to move it, and it's very difficult to find a place to move it to. So if you can't sell your home, you're probably going to lose your equity in your home. This has been a friction point between landlords and tenants in parks for years. Tenants believe that there are some bad landlords who do not reasonably approve buyers of their homes. Tenants would like the Department of Justice to pursue those few bad landlords. The Department of Justice is willing to do that. However, the primary method the Department of Justice uses to pursue consumer fraud is the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the UTPA, and that expressly excludes claims under the Landlord-Tenant Act. And the Landlord-Tenant Act cannot be enforced by the Department of Justice. So, in Section 1 and 2 of this bill, we are amending, adding a new section to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which would allow the Department of Justice only, not a private party, not the tenant, but allow the Department of Justice to investigate and pursue landlords who, as a pattern and practice, routinely reject unreasonably buyers of tenants' homes. And it imposes a four-year sunset. That is the main thing that the bill does. Okay. We also, in Section 9 of the bill, amend quite a few provisions of the one statute in the Landlord-Tenant Act which regulates sales of homes and the landlord's review of that. It decreases the amount of time that the tenant has to give advance notice from 30 days to 10 days. It decreases the amount of time the landlord has to review and decide on a buyer from 20 days to 7 days. It makes clearer what the buyer has to provide to the landlord. It makes clearer what the landlord's obligation is in reviewing that buyer. There are three smaller issues that benefit landlords that are also addressed in the bill. One of those has to do with a deposit return for abandoned property when that starts. Another one has to do with returning a rent payment to avoid waiver. And a third one has to do with a landlord's liability when a landlord sells an abandoned mobile home. I think I'm glazing people's eyes, so I'll stop.
Questions from the committee? Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, could you just clarify what are the conditions, or what, this is a lot and I don't know where I'm going, but what are the conditions that a tenant, or the property owner, or the park owner, can scrutinize who's going to buy, and he has 7 days to do that now, but are there conditions or certain guidelines that he has so he can't just arbitrarily reject a buyer? I mean, can you talk a little bit about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, there's a statute. It's 90.680, which is a part of the Landlord-Tenant Act. It's part of this bill. It's repeated in Section 9 of the Dash 2 amendments. I don't know whether you have the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments are the operative piece. And that's on page 46 to 50. What 9680 does, let's see if I can find the right page so I can steer you to it. In subsection 6 of 9680, which is on page 47, sub A says the landlord shall accept or reject the prospective purchaser application within, we're changing 20 days to 7 days. And the reason, from the tenant's point of view, is the concern that in 20 days, buyers get cold feet. And if they have to wait, if the landlord could currently make the buyer wait the full 20 days, and the fear for tenants is that the buyer will simply get tired of waiting and go find something else to buy. So that period is reduced to 7 days, following the time that the landlord gets a complete and written application. And then it goes on to say, required by the landlord pursuant to ORS 90.510, sub 5, sub H. 90.510 is a statute that very explicitly requires what has to be in a rental agreement between a manufactured homeowner, the tenant, and the park owner. And it says that the rental agreement has to list what those criteria are. So while the statute doesn't expressly say what the criteria are, it does require that the rental agreement provide what those criteria are. But they would be the typical things, screening, income, good credit, good references.
Follow up. So it wouldn't just be arbitrary on behalf of the park owner. It's basically he's not qualifying them as a purchaser, as like a bank would. He's just qualifying them as a tenant. And the person who might be buying that manufactured home from another manufactured homeowner has a different qualifying financial process, and it's more of a tenant-landlord process that's going on here. Because we do, I mean, in my district, we have a lot of folks who are, a lot of park issues where people are losing their homes, and I'm curious about this particular section. You know, we're not talking about any kind of financial obligations as far as they're qualifying to purchase anything. It's more qualifying to be a tenant in that manufactured home park, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, the landlord does care about the buyer's financial capacity because it's not easy, and it ought not to be easy, to evict a manufactured housing tenant, since an evicted home is worth very little, if anything. As I described earlier, it's expensive to move them, and it's hard to find another place to take them. So they can only be evicted for cause. So when a manufactured housing landlord accepts a manufactured housing tenant, they're talking about a long-term relationship. So the landlord does care about the financial capacity of the buyer. Let me just read to you what's in 9510 sub 5 sub H, which describes what those criteria can be. We're not amending that statute, by the way, so it's not in your dash twos. It says the landlord has to include in the rental agreement any conditions the landlord applies in approving a purchaser. Those conditions shall be in conformance with state and federal law and may include, or are not limited to, conditions as to pets. You would not believe how many issues there are regarding pets here. Number of occupants and screening or admission criteria. So those screening and admission criteria typically do include your credit record and your income. And you're right, there are two processes going on here. The owner of the home, the tenant, is making sure that the buyer of the home can pay him or her for the home. And then the tenant is evaluating the buyer to make sure that the buyer also can pay future rent and that the buyer will be a good tenant. Is that...
One follow-up.
Sure.
Follow-up. But any of those parameters that the landlord wants to put are in this... the document we talk about here on page 48, that has to be within that 7 days, that's all listed. Anything he is concerned about. So if there's something not listed there and the landlord says, oops, I reject this guy because of, you know, reasons X, Y, Z, and they weren't contained in there, then that's... He has to contain any of those issues that he has in there, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Van Lanningham, you addressed the notice of equity in the houses and this impact of not approving buyers. There is a practice that I've been hearing a lot about in which the owner of a park reduces the rent on a particular lot on which only the owner owns the house, owner of the park owns that house, instantly rendering the value, equity, and all the other houses basically to zero. Was this an issue that was addressed in this kind of effort to put together several elements addressing manufactured housing owners?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, it was very much an issue of the negotiations. It was not an issue that we could reach agreement on. I'm a tenant advocate. I would say that the tenants feel that we have addressed some of the tenant concerns with regard to sales, primarily the length of time the landlord has to review the purchaser, and making it clear that that the landlord's criteria have to be explicit, as Representative Gallegos was asking about, and then finally allowing the Department of Justice to investigate those bad actors, bad landlords, who we think are not reviewing applicants, buyers fairly. However, a landlord can continue, and some do, can continue to offer a better deal to buyers from the landlord. Often a landlord will own homes either that have been sold back to the landlord by a tenant or have been abandoned and the landlord owns. And the landlord, for example, could offer 5 years rent at a much lower rate than the tenant can offer, since the tenant can't control rent. Tenants think that's unfair. The landlords think that the tenants are not appreciating the true value of the home and are charging a higher price, and the landlords are adjusting for the lower rent and the price they charge. It's a market issue, and we could not reach agreement.
Thank you.
Other questions? Well, thank you, John. Since we just got these amendments yesterday afternoon, I think I'll give the committee time to just look through them, and we'll intend to bring this back on Monday.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3069. And I'm going to open a committee. I know you have lots to read, but if you have time to kind of look over these before we go forward, I'd appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to open a joint hearing on... I'm going to open a joint work session on House Bill 330 and House Bill, 3400. These are both bills that went before MLAC, and that's why they're a little late in arriving. And I'm going to call people up to testify on both bills. Okay, it's Rob Douglas, Linda Jefferson, Linda Barno.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Close, members of the committee. My name is Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Self-Insurers Association. With me on my right is Linda Barno, who is chair of the OSIA Legislative Committee and works with Schnitzer Industries. And on her right is Linda Jefferson, a member of the Self-Insurers Legislative Committee with the Risk Management Department of the City of Portland. Linda Barno will briefly describe both bills, and then we're available for any questions you may have.
Good morning.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Linda Barno with the Oregon Self-Insurance Association. I'll first be discussing briefly what House Bill 3300 does. House Bill 3300 would require that compensable claim, disabling claims, denied claims, and non-disabling claims be reported upon determination of compensability and the issuance of a notice of acceptance or notice of denial. This method would still allow the Workers' Compensation Department to establish the claim, enter the loss in their data system for statistical analysis to assess the compliance and claims processing performance of the self-insured or insured employer. And finally, the director would still also have the authority to require reporting of the claim as needed for incidental or significant issues, as in supplemental disability pay. This bill would eliminate dual filings, eliminate approximately 1,800 annual deferred reporting papers, and alleviate burdensome paperwork while providing the director with the necessary information. We feel the proposed method of reporting would allow this to continue at less cost and time. House Bill 3400 clarifies the role of the Workers' Compensation Department. If the insured or self-insured employer elects not to administer the supplemental disability benefits, it would also, if the Workers' Compensation Department chooses to, it could assign this administration of supplemental disability benefits to a third-party administrator. House Bill 3400 would amend ORS 656.210 subset 5B to specifically state that the director has a responsibility to administer and pay supplemental disability benefits when the insured or self-insured employer elects to. And in a nutshell, this really restores the supplemental disability process to the legislative intent of last year's SB 485. Thank you.
You ready?
Any questions?
Questions. Representative Rosenbaum.
Madam Chair, I don't know if you mentioned this, but in House Bill 3300, it looks like there's a new requirement of reporting denied claims as well as accepted ones. Is that new, or is that just appearing in a different place?
I think I misspoke. That's actually, we do report denied claims.
Currently.
This bill specifically addresses when a claim is in the deferred status, when there has not been a decision made. And we have a requirement under the various issues that were outlined within my brief document here of some of the many ways we are sending in paperwork when this can all be done at the time of either acceptance or denial of a claim.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have one other person on 3300, John Schultz from DCBS.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Excuse me. I am John Schultz, the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to come in today and testify in favor of House Bill 3300. The previous witnesses covered the main aspects of the bill, so I plan to be very brief. I did want to mention that the Management Labor Advisory Committee, in their meeting last Friday, proposed an amendment to this bill that the department conduct an evaluation of all claims reporting requirements that are in Chapter 656. You should have, I understand you do have that Dash 1 amendment in front of you. There will be no additional resources needed to conduct this evaluation of claims reporting requirements. We had already anticipated doing this as part of our move to electronic reporting of claims information. This bill, frankly, will streamline reporting requirements for insurers without affecting worker rights or benefits, and we request the committee forward this bill with a due pass recommendation. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions I can.
Questions for John? Everybody understands it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on... Oh, we are in work session. I'm sorry. We don't need to go to work session. We are in it. We have a Dash 1 Amendment Committee. I hope you've all found that on 3300.
Madam Chair,
Rosenbaum.
I would move the Dash 1 Amendment to House Bill 3300.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the Dash 1 Amendment into House Bill 3300. Is there discussion? Objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Rosenbaum.
I move House Bill 3300 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 3300 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallego. Aye.
Representative
Gerard.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative
Kitch.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye. Chair votes. Both aye. Motion carries. And Representative Knope will carry this bill. And on to 3400.
Representative Rosenbaum. I move House Bill 3400 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 3400 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Votes aye. Motion carries. And Representative Knope will carry this bill as well. And we'll close the work session on 3300, 3400. Thank you. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3544. Call Commissioner Dan Gardner and Deputy Talbot. And have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3544 modifies the limitations on penalty wages for failure to pay wages on termination, commits the court to award costs and attorney fees to prevailing parties in action to collect wages or action for collection of any order, check, memorandum, or other acknowledgement of indebtedness for wages, limits attorney fees for employee under certain circumstances. We have a dash one amendment that was passed out earlier this morning that we just received this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and should be with me today as Mr. Fuller with the automobile industry, or he shall be here shortly. This is one of those where you heard the testimony prior on this bill. Mr. Fuller and I worked out a compromise agreement for the unique situations within commissions on the automobile industry, and we're in total agreement on the amendment.
Well, that is so nice to hear.
Once in a while, Madam Chair, it does happen, honestly.
Can you walk us through the amendment? Do you have the dash one in front of you?
Actually, I don't. But okay.
I'm sorry.
What the amendment does is basically narrows this down. I believe I referred to this in the original hearing as something that needed laser surgery, but yet was using a Mack truck to do it, if I recall my comment correctly. So what we did was narrow this down to solely those commissions of the automobile industry, since they're the only one who seems to have a problem with this particular area, and limit it down so that what would happen is that they would only, what happens in the automobile industry from Mr. Fuller's testimony prior is that when an employee leaves that's on commission basis from the automobile industry, they work out their commission with the employer, but yet they'll come back a time later and find more commissions that are necessary that end up being a dispute between the employer and the employee. They'll go to court or through our process and ends up, oftentimes what happens is the employee will claim, for instance, that they have $1,500 coming. When we settle it out, it comes down to about $250 in some of those cases. So what we said is that the 30-day wage penalty in this particular situation does not apply unless the employee is entitled to 20% or more of the amount that they are asking for in the first place.
Okay. Other questions for Commissioner Gardner? Okay, thank you very much, and we'll call Daryl forward, and Dan, you feel welcome to stay for further questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller for the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Looked over the amendments. They solved the problem that we were looking for. And as the commissioner mentioned in his testimony when you first heard the bill, we found a scalpel instead of a shotgun. And so I commend the amendments to you and appreciate their willing to work with us on such short notice. Be glad to answer any questions.
I'm not sure if Dan said scalpel or laser. Which was it?
It really doesn't matter at this point, Manager.
I think the laser sounds better.
I remember the shotgun part.
Are there questions? Representative Merkley.
I just want to make sure I understand this correctly, Madam Chair. Say somebody says they're owed commissions of $10,000, and in the end it's determined they're owed commissions of less than $2,000, then in that case they're under the 20% and they would not get the penalty wages. The penalty wages would be reduced to just the
to 100% of the amount of the wages owed.
100% of that. Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, looks like a good compromise. Thank you. All right. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 30, I'm sorry, the dash 1 amendment into House Bill 3544.
Representative Kitts moves the dash 1 amendment into House Bill 3544. Is there a discussion? Objection. Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kitts.
I would move House Bill 3544 as amended to the House floor to be passed recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3544 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Gerard.
Aye.
Representative Berkeley.
Aye.
Representative
Joplin.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Chair
Close. Votes aye. Motion carries. And Representative Kitts will carry House Bill 3544 to the floor. Close the work session. And we will open a work session on House Bill 3229 and ask Commissioner Gardner to come forward and have the staff refresh our memory on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We last heard House Bill 3229 on April 9th. It allows the local joint apprenticeship committee to select an apprenticeship applicant for employment with applicant's family business under certain conditions. Thank you.
Good morning, again.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. You previously, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and with me is Steve Sims, who is the head of the Apprenticeship and Training Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And previously, you had a hearing on this bill. Unfortunately, I was slightly late and unable to testify. What I would have said at that time, and I guess I'll say now, is that this particular situation, I was a member of the legislature in 1999 when a similar bill was attempted to bring through the legislature, and I worked with then-Commissioner Roberts in order to defeat that bill, because this is one where you really, there is no problem that is being addressed in this particular bill. If you go back and you look at the history of apprenticeship, it used to be many, many years ago that it was, quite frankly, a good old boys network where you had to have a, you know, father or an uncle or someone related to you either as a contractor or as a tradesperson in that profession in order to get into the apprenticeship. Throughout the years, there are EEOC standards that have come into place to make sure that those situations do not exist anymore. In this particular situation, Mr. Goulet, I've talked to a number of occasions. I've talked to Mr. Goulet as a candidate for Labor Commissioner. I've talked to him as Labor Commissioner. Mr. Goulet has a son who I believe is a sophomore in high school. He did have a situation apparently some time ago where he had trouble with the particular apprenticeship and training committee that he is affiliated with in getting an apprentice to the coast. In a prior conversation with him over a year ago, I suggested to him that he get a particular book for the coastal book so that you have apprentices who actually want to work on the coast on that book, and it would be more available. As it happens with my conversations with the Bureau during both the campaign and as Labor Commissioner-elect, Steve Sims, the head of the Apprenticeship Training Council, and the head of the particular training agent that he is affiliated with, went to Mr. Goulet's home, spent over 2 hours, and created, the committee did create that coastal book system. Mr. Goulet's son has every advantage out there to get into the apprenticeship system. Mr. Goulet will undoubtedly teach his son, as I would my own son as an electrician, more about the craft. Mr. Goulet can certainly hire him as a parts person for his business. He can also, give him all of those advantages that will actually give him, a leg up on any and every other apprentice applicant for this particular program. What this will get us into, if this bill particularly passes, is the situation going backwards in time toward being more of the good old boy system. If you take a union program, for instance, since in the union programs you have cents per hour paid by the employee and the employer, you're going to have coming to you by next session employees who are saying, wait a minute, I pay into that program too, a cents per hour out of my wages. Why shouldn't my son or daughter be allowed direct entry into the program too? I pay just as much as the contractor does. Why should they have an elevation higher? It really is a step backwards in time. I would ask you, if you were talking here about doctors or lawyers, if I owned a law practice or a medical practice and I went through one of the state universities and I was a donor to their foundation, should I be allowed to have my son or daughter direct access over any other applicant within the state? There is nothing unique in the situation when we're talking about the construction and building trades. I believe that there is not a condition in this. There actually is another rule that we're putting through the Apprenticeship Training Council that I told Mr. Goulet about prior to our last meeting of the Apprenticeship and Training Council, that we're working out with the federal government for an exception to allow those that are current employees to work through to be able to have more direct access on a limited basis, which will be brought up at our next Apprenticeship and Training Council, which could be used very specifically for this particular purpose. However, we have to be very, very careful when we apply these exceptions. And exceptions are not, they are expressly forbidden by the federal government to be for the purposes of getting around equal opportunity employment situations. And we have to make sure that that is not used as a system to circumvent EEOC. We are, as always, willing to work with Mr. Goulet, but, you know, this is one where you have we're a solution in search of a problem.
Thank you, Commissioner. Steve, I just had a question about the coastal book system. Can you explain sort of what that is and
certainly
how it works?
Certainly, Representative Post, committee members. Our apprenticeship programs are broken down into geographic regions, and in the case of Mr. Goulet, his program has a geographic region that stretches from Wilsonville to Eugene, from the coast to the mountains. So when they solicit new apprentices, they're soliciting that whole broad region. That is their book. We have a list of people who can work this area. When Mr. Goulet sought a new apprentice, I don't know if it says anything about living on the coast, but he could not find anyone who wanted to move to the coast to work for him. What we worked out with his apprenticeship program was an agreement that we could have a separate book, same apprenticeship committee, but now in order to be sensitive to the geographical concerns, we have one book for the coastal area, one book for the rest of the existing geographic area of the program. The benefit for him is, I believe, for our whole coastal region, there are only five registered training agents affiliated with that apprenticeship committee, or five potential employers. We're certain that because Mr. Goulet would be able to give his son preparatory education, preparatory work experience in the trades, that of that limited group of employers, five out of the 74 affiliated with the committee, there's no reason why, simply based upon his merit alone, he would not be one of the first or second most qualified applicants. And that's why we object to the idea of creating a special exception just because of based on a family relationship.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Thank you for your testimony. And Representative Broom will not be testifying. So we're going to close the work session on House Bill 3229. We will skip House Bill 3662 for now because Representative Brown is not available. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 739, have the staff read the summary, and call Julie Ramis.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Find my paperwork. House Bill 739 bans the sale of certain types of goods at unused property market unless a person has authorization from manufacturer or distributor. It requires persons to keep records when purchasing new and unused property to sell at unused property market, and violations are punishable as misdemeanors. Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Julie Brandis. We are handing out our written testimony for you. Senate Bill 739 is a partner to another bill that has gotten a lot of attention in the legislature, and that's what we have started to refer to as the metal underpants bill. What 739 does is it does ban certain types of products, and the bill is very clear about the types of products, at unused property markets or flea markets. And this is a bill that has passed in 28 other states. The reason it's combined with Senate Bill 466, which isn't here in this committee at this time, is it's kind of a story, a line of how products move when they're stolen. And what happens is, you all have probably heard the term shoplifting, but there's a newer term that is used, and that is called boosting. And that is professional shoplifting, where a thief comes in generally in teams of 3 to 4 into a store, and they do what is called shelf sweeping. They're called boosters, and they essentially walk up to a shelf, and they might have their coats lined with aluminum, or their why we call it the metal underpants, underpants lined with aluminum, or bags lined with aluminum. And they sweep the shelf, and they pour all that, generally something like baby formula, which is one of the hottest products in the stolen market. And they take those to, this is when you turn to the pink sheet, and they take that stolen product to street fences. And then the street fences sell the product to flea market or middlemen, and then anyone can walk into a flea market and buy something like baby formula at something like half the price of what it sells retail. Of course, the fence is making 100% profit, while retailers are losing quite a bit of money. As an example, I have a 15-month-old daughter, and when we would get formula to supplement, it was always very hard when I sent my dear, dear husband to the grocery store, because he could not find the Enfamil. And the reason he couldn't find the Enfamil is they kept only one can of it on the shelf, because so much of it is getting stolen. And that's why 20 other states have passed this flea market legislation, is it prevents the sale of things like flea markets, the sale of things like baby formula at flea markets, things like Gillette razors. Gillette loses, they estimate, $2 billion annually on loss of products and stores to this professional crime. Those are just some of the examples. Batteries, film. So these are teams that are working. Second week of session, there was a big bust down in the Klamath Falls area of about $10,000 worth of baby formula in a car that was, there's no reason to have really $10,000 worth of baby formula in your car unless you have one very hungry baby. So that is why we are moving this legislation, and why it is so important and is similar to what we have done in other states as the retail associations. I don't know how many of you realize, but AOI does represent the nation's largest retailers and about 500 other retailers here in Oregon. And I'll answer any questions.
Representative Garrard has, I think it's a metal underwear question.
I just want to let you know that everybody's picking on Klamath Falls today, but...
go ahead.
The individual was not a native of Klamath Falls.
Madam Chair and Representative Garrard, I think it says a great deal about your law enforcement community that they were able to crack this crime in Klamath Falls, because it actually occurred and the formula was actually stolen in the valley.
Thank you very much for clearing that up. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair. Representative Gagel.
So we're just chuckling over here, wondering, if this bill should pass, are you going to provide a pair of metal underwear for whoever is carrying this bill today on the floor to wear them to demonstrate it, on the floor of the House?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we'll do anything the carrier needs. That's a part of our responsibility as staff at AOI.
Well, this will be fun.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Julie, the... staff manager Semry says that there was a fiscal impact statement issued, and I don't think we have a copy of it. Do you remember, was there a fiscal impact?
I don't recall ever seeing a fiscal impact or being told that there was one.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry, I should have provided this in your packets. But they comment, there's no numbers per se, but just because of the creating a misdemeanor for the sales of certain unused products, that there's...
local jail time and whatnot. So I will provide those for members.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yeah, I'm sure there would be if the local officers decided to prosecute it. What's interesting to know, and I've actually learned quite a bit more about metal underwear in the last 2 years than I've ever really wanted to know, because we retailers, especially the larger retailers, recognize the problems that law enforcement has and the numbers of crimes they have to investigate, they've actually begun doing a lot of their own operations where they, in fact, the Klamath Falls situation, again, was a situation where all the research, all the investigation had been done by private investigators hired by the retail community. We actually just turned over all that information, and generally who you're getting off the street, we believe 90% of the money that goes into these crimes goes to obviously the drug crime. So they're probably doing a pretty good service for the state of Oregon and for the region.
I guess the only thing that comes to mind, though, is what's going on in terms of prosecution of misdemeanors right now, mm-hmm. is that it's not happening, and crimes are being downgraded from misdemeanors to violations if they're... Mm-hmm. So I assume this might fall in the same category.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, definitely retailers across the state are having a very hard time getting any of their crimes prosecuted. The good news about following up on such on these rings is generally you get a connection to where a drug ring actually exists. On the other hand, on funding our courts, that's something AOI has been very vocal about this session, and we have actually agreed to increase the fees that we pay to civil courts.
Thank you.
Other questions, Representative Gallegos?
What's to prevent, though, someone who has a garage sale or yard sale? How can you distinguish those? And I didn't realize there's a time frame, but...
Madam Chair and members of the committee, there is an exemption for what you would classify as a garage sale within the bill. I didn't actually bring the copy of the bill with me. Additionally, it's only certain products. So if you're selling quite a bit of baby formula, it might be one thing if you had some left over from your child growing up. But we're talking about a lot of product that is for sale. But there is an exemption, and I'm sorry I don't have the bill in front of me. But it's like 12 times, and it's, you know, or 6 times a year, and such and such. And again, it's certain products that can't be sold. But that's a good question. That's something we've dealt with in all 28 other states that this legislation has passed, because we certainly don't want to have a crackdown on garage sales.
Representative Gallegos, I think in Section 1, page 2, subsection C, and Julie, is this what you're referring to? It says, where new and unused property is offered for sale or exchange for more than 12 days in one 12-month period.
That's correct.
Okay. Oh, a long garage, though. Other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much.
You.
We're very interested in this concept. Appreciate you bringing it. Okay, that concludes our witnesses on this bill. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 739. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 739. Representative Rosenbaum.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 739 be sent to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves Senate Bill 739 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Gallegos.
Will Representative Rosenbaum choose to wear the decorative underclothes to carry this bill?
I did not fully volunteer to carry this bill. I'm not sure, Representative Gallegos.
I'm looking for those with a burning desire. Representative Merkley, do you have a burning desire?
No, Madam Chair. having had the privilege, the honor, really, bestowed upon me by the chair of carrying the steel erection bill, I'd like to share those honors. But just to clarify, is Senate Bill 466 going to be on our docket? And isn't it 466 that is the actual, if you will, metal underpants bill?
Julie Brandes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is actually 466 that deals with using theft detection using something to prevent the detection of theft. That is Senate Bill 466. That has gone to Judiciary in the Senate, and probably because it deals with the burglary statutes, it will go to Senate or House Judiciary if it should move. So if you want to reserve the metal underpants on the floor for, you know, maybe Representative Williams or something, that might be a better idea.
We should have a more prepared
We
got out of that. Further discussion.
We were thinking Representative Krupp might be interested.
Oh, okay. Well, he's not here to defend himself. The clerk will call the roll. Oh, I'm sorry. We didn't have a motion, did we? Yes, we did. Representative Rosenbaum moved the bill, and we got distracted. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Merkley?
Aye.
Representative
Drossler?
Aye.
Representative Gibbs? Is excused.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair
Close? Both aye. Motion carries.
Madam Chair?
Representative Gerard?
I would suggest that since Representative Kitts is not here, the chair perhaps entertained the idea that he might carry this bill.
Okay, well, that's an excellent idea, and Representative Kitts, wherever you are, you're the carrier. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 739. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 602 called Daryl Fuller.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller for the Oregon Auditors Association. Senate Bill 602 comes to you from the Senate side, obviously, with only one opposing vote on the floor, no opposition in the Senate Business Committee, and no opposition testimony when the bill was heard in the Senate. Simply put, the bill eliminates liability for businesses that provide use of vehicles to others as part of their business. This issue became significant last year when a captive leasing company in New York was held liable for damages in an accident in New York. And leasing companies said that if they were going to be responsible for the drivers that they provide leases to, that they just weren't going to provide leases to customers anymore. I've provided a couple of articles from an industry-related magazine that we receive in our office that talks about the most recent one, talks about the largest non-captive holder of leases in the nation starting July 1st will refuse to accept leases in New York, I believe Rhode Island and Connecticut, and it's going to be sweeping this direction with more and more companies dealing in more and more states refusing to provide leases to consumers. The bill that we have before us would still keep protections in the law and when a business provides a vehicle to another person. The three limits on that liability protection are, one, if there's negligence in providing the vehicle. An example there would be if you're at an airport and you're renting a car and you're clearly intoxicated, the rental company would still be liable for renting a car to an intoxicated person. The business would still be liable if they provided a vehicle that was not mechanically sound. You provide a vehicle that doesn't have brake fluid in it. You have to provide people with a good vehicle, obviously. And it specifically states that nothing in the bill absolves a manufacturer from manufacturing defects, so they wouldn't be able to use that as a way to protect themselves from damage that was caused, and you know, whether it's a side impact explosion because of gas tanks or any of the other problems with manufacturing of vehicles that you hear about, that this would not be used as a shield for that. It simply indicates that when a vehicle's in the accident, the drivers involved are responsible, not the person who provided the vehicle. And I'd be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Questions? Representative Gallegos.
Just to talk about test driving, and not that I do that often, but I don't recall that I give insurance information when I test drive a car. Is it just a presumption that they have insurance?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, it depends on the dealership. In order for this to protect a dealership in the case of a test drive, and the exemption deals with whether it's a rental, a loaner, a lease, a test drive. And by the way, this issue came to my attention actually 4 or 5 years ago when I had a dealer
who became frustrated because he was loaning vans out to different school groups or church groups or into parades. And when those vehicles would get into accidents, he would end up paying for damages because he was a nice guy and was loaning vehicles to people. And he said he's just going to stop being the nice guy in the community. This was out in LeGrand, and there aren't a lot of car dealers out there. When people needed a car donated or a van donated, they'd come to him, and he was always happy to do that. And so he had started to have to pay for it. And so the shield is for all of those, and it only protects you if you have a signed agreement with the business indicating that you are responsible and that your insurance is responsible. So dealerships would have the option of saying, if you want to test drive this vehicle, sign this agreement, and in that case that would put your insurance on the hook. If you don't have a written agreement with the business, then their insurance would still be on the hook for an accident in that case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to ask you about this second sentence starting on line 23 that is being deleted. If the person receiving the motor vehicle uses the motor vehicle in the course of a person's employment, any insurance available to the employer, ... is also primary, and any insurance available to the person providing the motor vehicle is secondary. So in that case, doesn't that sentence say essentially the leasing company is secondary? And given what you've described, why would you want to eliminate that primary-secondary structure?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, that's specifically the point of the legislation, in that under current law, if there is an accident, the business providing the vehicle is liable. It's second in line, but it is liable for damages in the accident, which means that if the driver, in the case of a lease, for example, or a rental, if they tell us they have insurance, give us an insurance policy number, provide us whatever information we need, but they're lying to us. They don't really have insurance. Well, the statute says we're second. So since they don't have any insurance available to them, we then become first. Or if they do, in fact, have insurance, but the damages as a result of the accident go beyond the limitations of that person's insurance, it's a catastrophic accident with, you know, an enormous amount of costs and the policy of the driver of the lesser of the vehicle has a $500,000 cap on their insurance, whatever the requirement is, then we're on the hook after that. And we simply don't believe that by providing the vehicle, we ought to be liable for that person's driving habits.
Additional question, Madam Chair. If there are defects in the vehicle that lead to an accident, such as a tire that has a bubble in it or a wheel falls off the vehicle or something like that, is the leasing company completely off the hook with this legislation?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, there is a provision in the bill that says that if they are negligent in providing the vehicle in terms of its mechanical quality, that whoever provides the vehicle is liable. Now, in the case of a lease where you're offering it for 36 months, I would guess that at some point the leasing company would say that they are absolved from that responsibility because it's the customer who's responsible for the care of the vehicle. And, you know, at what point, there isn't a specific nexus in there. Obviously, over a 36-month period of time, you may change out tires and may have other problems with the vehicle that the leasing company would not be responsible for. In the cases of probably more specific in the case of a loaner or a rental car that you'd have for just a couple of weeks or a couple of days, if there was a defect in the tire, again, didn't have enough brake fluid, or there was a mechanical problem, then the person providing the vehicle would be liable in that case. And I said there's a specific exception in there for manufacturing defects. If it was something that went wrong with the manufacturing of the vehicle, this wouldn't absolve the manufacturer from their liability.
One last follow-up.
Last
follow-up. Thank you. This, in deleting the language about the leasing company, we're also deleting some other language about the employer of the person being the primary policy. Does that throw up in question issues? For example, if my company leases a car and I'm in an accident, does that throw into question whether or not my company's insurance takes precedent or my personal insurance takes precedent, or is that still clear within the law?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, not from the Legislative Council, so I'd be real nervous about commenting specifically on that. I will tell you that in terms of the use of a business vehicle for business purposes, I assume that there's are other statutes dealing specifically with work-related accidents that would make it clear that the employer is responsible in those cases. This statute deals only with the vehicles. And actually, that language that you're looking at that's being deleted has only been on the books for about four years. And so I assume it was settled law prior to that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Daryl. And that concludes our witnesses on Senate Bill 602. I'm closing the public hearing, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 602. Representative Gerard?
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 602 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gerard moves Senate Bill 602 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallegos? Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative
Berkley?
Aye.
Representative Kitts?
Is excused.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close?
Both aye. Motion carries. And Representative Rosenbaum, would you carry this? Sure. Okay. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 602. Okay, we have, I'm going to open a, let's see. We already have the hearing on 622.
No,
we have. It's a new bill. Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3622 and call Jim Welsh and have the staff explain the situation on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3622 makes a person's working from home assembling photon light products non-subject workers for purposes of workers' compensation insurance. We had a bill prior to this dealing with the same issue, and this is another way of going about it. Thank you.
And Jim Welsh is coming, Oregon State Grange.
Chair Close and members, I'm Jim Welsh, representing Oregon State Grange, and our House Bill 3622 is taking care of the workers' comp area that we need to, in statute, to allow for at-home workers. Employer, at this point in time, when you look at the situation, cannot house them in a manufacturing or a assembly plant in the small town of Blatchley, Oregon. We talked about this earlier in another bill, and as we worked with the work group, the employment department said we probably needed to take care of statute 656027 for at-home workers, and so that's why we have this. We've drawn it up as narrow as possible, so we didn't open up the possibility of allowing for others, other situations between employer and employees to work into this similar situation. And you know that, as we discussed before, we needed something very narrow. Well, this is the bill. And for all reasons, and those reasons out of the control of the employer would not want to pay for workers' compensation premiums, even if a carrier were to write those. And we're not speaking for SAFE or Liberty Northwest, the two workers' comp carriers that I'm familiar with. We're not speaking for them, but believe me, I don't think they would want to write a program for at-home workers either, and I know the employer wouldn't want to pay for it. So it's a situation where we need this exemption, this exclusion in statute, so that we can get these people back to work, and that's about all it does right at this point in time.
Okay, just to clarify, this is not the bill that we've heard before. This is a new way of dealing with the situation, new bill, correct?
This we needed in, along with the other bill. No matter what we do with the other bill, we need this exclusion anyway, this exemption,
okay,
as I understand it. So we've worked with the employment department, and believe me, with the workers, the comp department in DCBS, and a lot of credit to them. They have just been a real joy to work with, and I provided my my language and for the bill, and I got immediate responses. They were there when we talked about it again before the Management Labor Advisory Committee on Friday, and so we had plenty of support and plenty of help.
Questions? Senator Shoffler.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Are all those folks you just rattled off in support of this?
We did not get an approval through MRAC on Friday.
Other questions?
Madam Chair,
Representative Rosenbaum.
Just to clarify, the workers that we're talking about were previously exempt under the independent contractor statutes, is that correct? And then that went away when that was called into question? Is that what created this problem?
Right. Someone had gone in for, as they were working as independent contractors, yes, at that point in time, when they were self-defining themselves as independent contractors, they were exempt, yes.
Other questions? Okay. Did you have a question?
Yeah.
Representative Merkley.
So if I understand correctly, then we're taking one particular activity and saying now that they'll be working as employees, but we won't be covered by workers' comp, and we're making it precisely to this one product, and that's the extent of the bill.
That's the extent, as I understand, of the bill. It's 3622.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
That concludes our witnesses on House Bill 3622. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3622. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 3622. Representative Kitts.
Chair, I would move that we accept House Bill 3622. I move to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3622 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are people on our panel here who know a lot more about workers' comp, and so I appreciate their input. I feel very sympathetic to the business operating and their ability to continue operating, and with the advantages of working from home, I feel nervousness about taking one group of workers and saying that if they have work-related injuries, they have no compensation protection. And I would just ask members who have looked at this more closely to share their thinking on the balance there. And maybe we don't have any, maybe the member who I was
Madam Chair,
Representative Shoffler.
You know, I'm going to be very frank. I am not sympathetic to this business owner because, in my opinion, this is just a way to get around workman's compensation. That's what I think, and that's why I will be voting no. Thank you.
Okay, well, committee, I would just direct you to the bill, and I would show you that this statute has all kinds of exemptions in it. It goes on for several pages. Because people have asked for these exemptions, and they are expensive, as you can see.
Madam Chair,
Representative Kitts,
just for the purpose of discussion, and maybe I'm not familiar with photon beams, lights to the degree that I should be in my legislative position here. I am more familiar with them now. So. It would appear that something like this is not a high-risk job. It's not a job that people would hurt themselves and yet be subject for business purposes of this, you know, burden of a workman's comp. I mean, I'm a small business owner. I carry it. It is a burdensome thing, and I think that if we can make exemptions in certain things where maybe people aren't at risk in order to help businesses in our state and help those folks, it's a thing worth at least exploring. Thank you.
Representative Merkley.
I'm just genuinely conflicted, but my my concern is that, I mean, shouldn't, if there is such a low-risk activity, shouldn't there be a very low-risk insurance rate that would accurately reflect that? And therefore, rather than punching a hole, just ensure that that appropriate risk level insurance is available instead of no insurance. I mean, having never assembled these, I have no idea the risk, but it does suggest the possibility of, if I'm doing thousands of these, there may be repetitive motion issues that occur with that type of assembly. I don't know if there is or not, but it seems like maybe the appropriate mechanism is is the insurance rate, not no insurance for a low risk activity. So that's my queasiness over leaving workers unprotected.
Representative Rosenbaum,
you know, we normally don't pass bills dealing with workers' comp here without the stamp of approval of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and it does concern me a little bit. I mean, I don't know if there's anybody here that was present at their meeting to tell us what their thinking was when they didn't. I mean, I don't know whether it was that they didn't support this, that they didn't consider it, or is there anybody here that knows the answer to this?
Tim, can you want to come forward?
Chair Close and members and Representative Rosenbaum, there was not a vote called for. It's kind of a feeling within the room. There's some questions about it. And so the chair at the time said that he sensed he did not have the vote to pass it. And certainly we talked about a lot of the same issues, a lot of the same questions that you've asked about this particular issue. But we, and I stress, you know, these people and the owner, the business owner, and the individuals have always, and they came before this committee and said that we accept this risk because we're trapped in a geographic situation, and we can't do anything else, and we want these jobs in our small community. And the owner, of course, would have a choice of taking it somewhere else and building a, where he could build an assembly plant or sending them offshore. The fact is that if we don't allow them to do business as they thought they should be able to do business, it goes away. We lose nearly 100 jobs in the state of Oregon. And I still say that we've heard a lot about jobs, and we're now beginning to define those who are talking out both sides of their mouth. If we're going to help people in the state of Oregon, we've got to do something about it.
Madam Chair, if I could ask a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have a sense of whether there is an appropriate workers' comp category and a sense of whether, have there been injuries assembling these type of products? Has there been any evidence of risk to the workers in terms of repetitive motion or other issues?
Chair Close and Representative Merkley, talking to a lot of those who are working out there hasn't been any problems with that. And it is just, you know, you saw the little lights. There's not much to putting them together, and it's pretty low risk. There's no doubt about it. It's the other issues that, you know, which hours are you working, and did you really, fall off your chair when you fell asleep and break your arm? And those things are out of control of an employer at home, and that's why the exemption is probably needed in this particular situation. And
okay, Representative Kitts, and then we're going to the vote.
Very quickly, and how long has this company been in business?
They're into their about sixth year. Started very small.
Yes.
Have there ever been a case of a worker being injured while performing this function?
I cannot honestly, Chair Close, Representative Kitts, I cannot honestly answer that. There weren't any indication they had a problem with them working at home when they were self-defining themselves as independent contractors, and when they lost that, you know, then they, now those people are working under the, a few of them are being able to assemble them, and that there was any indication there was any problem. The problem arose, and why they were then questioned about their status as an independent contractor was because someone had lost their ability to work with the company,
No, I understand all that. My question is just very simple. No one has ever been injured assembling these photons in 6 years.
Not that I know.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, committee. Thank you, Jim. I just want to make the last comment. If you look down this statute, these are a list of exemptions. You've got people distributing newspapers that are older than 19. You've got adult foster care people. You've got people volunteering. You've got caddies at golf courses. You've got recreation downriver boating, taxi cabs, on and on and on. Groups that have asked, action programs, foster grants, they've asked to be exempted. So this, there is a precedent for doing this. I just want to make that clear. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Berkley? Aye.
Representative
Chopper?
No.
Representative
Kitts?
Aye.
Representative
Rosenthal?
No.
Chair
Close? Votes aye. Motion carries. And House Bill 3622 goes to the floor. We will have Representative Brown carry the bill. And close the work session. Okay, we have one bill left, committee. It's a rather extensive bill that we've seen before. And so we will intend to give this a half-hour hearing. We have extensive amendments, so we are going to call forward several people on these amendments. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2341 and have the staff refresh our memory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, we last looked at House Bill 2341 in early February. In short, it is the revises the requirements and procedures for public contracting. We have a dash 7 amendment, which modifies almost every section of the bill and provides for legal remedies in the bill as well.
And I will call Jessica Harris. She's probably
gone on vacation.
Oh, there she is. And Drew, did you want to come up with Jessica? Well, just be Jessica.
That looks scary.
Are there 20 copies there?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no. There are 20 copies of one piece of paper and not of every piece of paper. And what I really need is about 50 more pieces of paper, and I should be good to go for the day. So thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to come this morning and testify on House Bill 2341. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris, and I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. To talk about the dash 7 amendments to House Bill 2341, which are a 52 very short page amendment that does do significant changes to this bill. Very briefly, the dash 7s remove sections 45, 65, 66, 69, 70, 73, 82, and 87 from the bill. They resolve the concerns or attempt to resolve the concerns brought forward on the product of and services of disabled individual provisions by removing sections 31 through 35 of the bill, by restoring 279, 835, to 855 that were removed by the bill. Section 5, sub 4 was added to say that sections 25 through 30, the cooperative procurements, and 50 through 57, 279B source selection procedures do not apply to 279, 835 to 855. Current law with respect to products and services of disabled individuals exempts them from competitive bidding and proposal procedures, not from necessarily the product, but from the way that you get there. And so what we've done is exempt them from the procedure. The way that 279C is constructed, the exemption portion in 103 and its companion 105 is constructed the same way as in current law. So we have taken in 103 sub 1 sub A, and we have taken the same exact language in current law and moved it and put it right there. So it is mirrors current law and affects no change as best we can tell. Bowley raised concerns about the definition of grant, and we have added clarifying language that provides context that a grant is not the actual contract that results in the implementation of the grant. Additional concerns were raised by Bowley about the federal override provisions. Federal government doesn't have our of labor requirements. Oregon does. We have defined conflict, so to say that to the extent that the federal government is more stringent or that you have to follow their requirements in order to get funding, that's what a conflict is, and then you have to follow federal government, otherwise Oregon prevails. Section 7 was amended to streamline and remove unnecessary language with respect to DAS's authority under House Bill 2341. City Eugene brought forward a series of issues with 2341. I believe it was about 80 points. Among the many points that they brought forward were concerns about the many rulemaking references in 2341. We have changed Sections 10 and Sections 11, which deal with rulemaking both for the Department of Justice and for local agencies. We have also removed many of the rulemaking references throughout statute. The delegation provisions of Section 12 were streamlined. Section 18 had many provisions that were a little mucked up, and so we have streamlined those and clarified them to make them simpler and easier to use. Sections 25 through 30 were amended to address concerns and simplify and ease the use of the competitive cooperative procurement process. They raised the threshold for advertising a permissive cooperative procurement and reduced some of the administrative requirements. A policy on public procurement was added, as were the legal remedies sections that didn't previously exist in the bill. They were placeholders in 2341. The ceiling for the intermediate procurement process was raised from $75,000 to $150,000 in Section 54. Right now, you could, under 2341, you could do a three-quote process up to $75,000 for public purchasing, and we have now allowed it up to $150,000. Section 56, in response to your concern from the City of Eugene, streamlined the emergency procurement language. We believe it makes it much easier given the definition. Section 63 was amended to clarify when a bidder proposer may be disbarred. 77 streamlined contracts conditions related to tie hour and labor provisions. Conformity amendments were added and technical amendments were made throughout the bill. There are 10 issues that we are aware of. We're aware of this morning when I wrote these. We've been made aware of a few more that remain to be completed either here or on the Senate side, and they are to finish the conforming amendments, to correct a minor issue with the Treasury language to make sure that the acquisitions of bonds are not subject to 279. We don't want the Treasury to go out and have to buy the cheapest stocks available. That doesn't make sense. We want to correct some language on personal services contracts to address some concerns raised by the PUDs. We are of the understanding that we can do that within the next couple of days. The Housing Department has some concerns about the grant language, and Bowley has some concerns about the Housing Department language and wants to make sure that the grant language stays the same, so we need to get everyone in a room and talk about it so that everyone's comfortable. Section 12, we want to make sure that it doesn't apply to 279-845. The City of Lake Oswego had a legal remedies concerned. This issue is nearly resolved. We have some language floating around on that. TriMet has an issue with Section 6 of federal override provision, some concerns about current law and how that works, and so we're trying to clarify that process and make sure that they understand what this does and see if we can't resolve it without an amendment. Section 9, Legislative Council added Section 335, which essentially says that once the bill becomes effective, and it becomes effective once it's signed, although it doesn't become operative until March 1, 2005, that once it becomes effective, that we can start writing administrative rules so that once it becomes operative, everything's ready to go. No one asked for this provision to be put in there. We aren't even sure if it's necessary. If it is necessary, that's great. If it isn't, that's fine too. The Fair Competition Alliance has suggested that they have concerns with it. So it's up to Legislative Council. If they say we need it, that's fine. If we don't, take it out. City of Eugene has concerns related to special procurements, competitive seal proposals, and cooperative procurements. We've worked through many of these issues already with them. We want to see if their concerns are primarily dealt with in these amendments or if there are still some things that we need to work out with them. We are committed, as always, to continuing to work with folks. One of the key things that is important to us is to have those concerns brought to us. We have done our very best, Madam Chair, members of the committee, to address any and all concerns that are brought to us and to try and reach resolution, and we'll continue to do so. We are at the pleasure of this committee, recognizing that timeline is short on this side, but also recognizing that there are some that still have concerns. We are happy to continue to try and resolve those over here, or understanding that we are running short on time to move these over the Senate and do so as well.
Well, Jessica, you have addressed every concern that was brought to me that I transferred to you. I don't know many people that could have addressed all these concerns in the time that you've had, so you've just done an outstanding job. I really want to commend you for this.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I do think the committee needs time to look over what you've passed out, and I do want to give them a chance to ask questions. So we don't intend to move on it today, but we do want to make sure that when it leaves the House, it is in good shape, and we are running out of time.
Okay.
Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. As the committee knows, that during the interim, I was the chair of the work group that worked on this public contracting law. And it is indeed, you know, the this is just this committee, since we started hearing it, that this is the gone with the wind of this legislative session. It is indeed a work in progress, as we learned during the interim. And the longer we take in working on it, the more people become aware of it with their concerns. And I just wanted to compliment Jessica on trying to address those concerns. There's a lot of them because this bill touches so many people in the way it'll be administered. But it is a work in progress, and I know it's still years away from reaching any kind of final decision-making. But my compliments to you and all of the folks who have come forward who are willing to work on making it a good bill. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I would add to the committee that what you have here are hand engrossed. Jessica has gone to a great deal of trouble to hand engross all the amendments for you, so that it should be fairly easy to go down her sheet and see what's been done in the bill. Questions, Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. Ms. Harris, you have the patience of an oyster. I just want to ask this question for the record, though. The intent of this legislation is not and never has been in any way to harm qualified rehabilitation facilities or the individuals with disabilities or the disabled individuals who they try to employ or to displace any workers. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Shoffler, that is absolutely correct.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, would it be the pleasure of this committee that to the extent that we can resolve the concerns that we have listed on the second page of my handout, that we bring amendments back on Monday to do so, or whenever you would like to recall this bill?
If you could do that by Monday, that would be very helpful to us. It gives us time to, lots of time to spend our whole weekend looking this
over.
I don't know about you, but I'm doing it tonight.
It'd be great cure for insomnia.
I would appreciate that, and we will intend to put it on the schedule for Monday. And I think what I'll do, committee, is at that time take testimony on what has been presented today, as far as we have time.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. Well, committee, we've gone through the agenda, and I appreciate very much your hard work. And is there anything else for the... Oh, I'm going to close the work session, excuse me, on 2341. Is there anything else for the good of the committee? Seeing nothing, we are adjourned.
Yeah, I agree.